There are very few jokes, if any, in NATO, but I can tell you one anecdote. It was when Montgomery was appointed the first Deputy Supreme Allied Commander. Churchill was asked his opinion about the appointment, and he said, Montgomery, in defeat, defiant, in victory, steadfast, in NATO, thank God, invisible at last. The problem we face, of course, from a public point of view, is that NATO was, from a public point of view, largely invisible during the Cold War. It's very visible today, and it invites a lot of public scrutiny, which is why the kind of meetings we had yesterday appear in the newspapers very much on the front page. It was invisible because NATO didn't do very much, but now it's been doing a lot, from Afghanistan to Libya. It was invisible because, from the public point of view, the Soviet threat was over the horizon. But now, as you heard from the minister, you have an increasingly assertive Russia, but we also have problems of migration, and we have problems of terrorism, and this divides, as you could see this week, the two presidents, Macron and Trump. Now, when Macron talks about NATO being brain dead, he means strategically brain dead, that it's incapable of thinking about its future or getting its priorities right, and that's why we've decided to have this conference today. And it's splendid that we're starting off this morning with three people who do think about the future and do think strategically. And in the order in which they will speak, first of all, I'd like to introduce Ambassador Tadjan İldem. I'm not going to say much because their biographies are out and we must start as soon as we can, but he's NATO Assistant Secretary General for Public Diplomacy. Our next speaker will be Dr. Thomas Rees, who is a Professor of Security and Strategy at the Swedish Defence College. And finally, my old friend James Scher, who's a senior fellow of the Estonian Foreign Policy Institute. I've asked them, it's very challenging to speak just for 12 minutes, and then we'll open it up to Q&A. So, Ambassador, if you would start us off.
Well, first of all, it is a great pleasure to be here today to address such a distinguished audience, and I have to congratulate LSE Ideas and New Strategy Center. We take pride to be part of this endeavor as NATO's public diplomacy division. The timing of the event is so good, just immediately after the leaders' meeting, which I had the privilege to attend as well, like the minister. And I must say that with all the coverage that you referred to on media outlets, newspapers. The meeting was extremely useful, and NATO not only had the opportunity to mark the 70th anniversary of the founding of this great alliance, which has contributed to our security of over 1 billion citizens of our countries, but also the leaders had a very important political debate regarding the present and future of the alliance. We have to recognize the fact that since 2014, as Minister rightly referred to, we have strengthened our deterrence and defense with a number of measures. Because of the changed security environment, we have to recall the illegitimate annexation of Crimea by Russia and aggressive actions in eastern part of Ukraine. But at the same time, since 2014, we have been dealing with threats emanating from different directions, particularly from the southern neighborhood. And we more and more have terrorist attacks, and we need to deal with state and non-state actors and what kind of challenges that they pose. Yesterday's meeting was important in the sense also to reflect on what kind of new challenges and threats allies have to face now and in the future. We more and more talk about China in our discussions. At the same time, we follow the technological advancement. Artificial intelligence, big data, disruptive technologies, and we need to keep the technological edge of the alliance, and we need to make sure that we are prepared for the challenges posed by these technological advancements, but also seize those opportunities to reinforce the defense capacity and capability of NATO. When we talk about strengthening deterrence and defense, the minister elaborated on a number of measures. Yes, we tripled the size of NATO's response force. We also have the enhanced and tailored forward presence, the four multinational and rotational battle groups in Baltic countries and in Poland. We have the spearhead force, very high level readiness task force. We also initiated in 2008 Brussels summit meeting a new project, NATO's Readiness Initiative, to have 30 battalions, 30 combat ships, and 30 squadrons to be ready and available at any place within 30 days. And the good news is that with the new announcements at the leaders' meeting, we are now ready to announce that NATO readiness initiatives is in place and to meet our requirements. Now, one important issue that the minister referred to several times, it is resilience. What we are dealing with nowadays is the intensity and speed of hybrid activities. In the past, we also had hybrid actions, threats. It goes back to the use of Trojan horse as a hybrid activity. Nevertheless, the sophistication of hybrid tactics nowadays requires each individual allied nation and our partners to strengthen their societal resilience, to make sure that we are aware of what kind of challenges and threats we are exposed to, and to be able to deal with these challenges with necessary capabilities and capacities. And in that sense, it is commendable to see a number of allied nations and partners, for instance, Norway's defense concept, Swedish civil defense concept. These are all with a view to strengthening their societal resilience to resist different types of attacks that they may encounter in from different directions. Now, a few words on those challenges that we are feeling more and more, especially with the demise of a very important arms control instrument, INF treaty. It makes arms control and disarmament an important focus topic for now and for the future. NATO has always been making contributions in this field. We need to preserve the fundamental instruments One example is non-proliferation treaty. We should also energize our efforts to induce the Russian Federation to engage in modernization of the Vienna document for transparency and risk reduction measures. And also to make sure that we have additional means and ways to have proper arms control and verification measures. Few words on the joint declaration that the leaders issued yesterday, and it specifies a number of areas that we have so far made progress, but also the necessity to strengthen the political dimension of NATO. As you know, President Macron was critical about lack of consultation and coordination among allies. And I think we should recognize the fact that NATO provides a unique platform of transatlantic consultations. And in fact, allies are consulting on a daily basis on a number of very critical issues. If we recall the joint statement of last year's Brussels summit meeting, our leaders endorsed more than 100 decisions, some of them extremely important, as I refer to NATO readiness initiative. But in any case, it is time for NATO to have a proper reflection process, to have a decision to be approved by foreign ministers in April under the auspices of the Secretary General to form a group of eminent persons to provide a report until the next summit meeting to take place in 2021. And I think when we talk about this reflection process, it will basically be focusing on how NATO could strengthen its political dimension. And it is good that these ideas have come from different allied countries, including France, who has been not so favorable regarding the political dimension of NATO. Basically, France has always considered NATO to be a military alliance, although, in my judgment, it is a political military alliance, and it is good that now this reflection process could be able to focus on the political dimension of the work of NATO. It was also an important occasion, not only marking the 70th anniversary of NATO, but also to show that our open door policy is still alive and functioning well. We had the Prime Minister of the Republic of North Macedonia, which will soon be acceding in NATO as the 30th member of the alliance. The ratification of the accession protocol is underway, and we are expecting Spanish Parliament in the coming days to ratify the accession protocol. And with the completion of this ratification process, North Macedonia will join NATO as the 30th member. Partnerships of NATO is extremely important, and we not only expand our practical cooperation, but also political dialogue with these partners in order to have their contribution for our shared security. One last point, of course, NATO is composed of democratic nations, and we share the same principles and values, and every allied country has different perspectives and priorities when it comes to the shared security and what NATO should do. And we may, from time to time, have differences of opinion. It's quite natural. Nevertheless, I can testify to the fact that yesterday's meeting and the successful conclusion of the leaders' meeting once again has proven that cohesion and unity of allies is fundamental. And no matter whether we have differences of opinion, we agree on the fundamentals. And it was true in the past because we encountered a number of difficult debates from Suez Canal crisis to Iraqi war. But still, we could be able to agree on important decisions. And one for all for one is still the underlying essential characteristic of NATO. And this gives us confidence for now and for the future.
Thank you very much. Dr. Rees.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I've been asked to speak about NATO's narrative and how the Nordic-Baltic countries see this and see the future. I should also start with a short caveat, which is that I'm correctly referred to as at the Swedish National Defense College, but I'm actually from Finland. And why I make this distinction will be quite clear when I give my presentation. About the narrative and the Nordic-Baltic states, first we have to distinguish which Nordic-Baltic states do we mean, because there are five of them that are frontline states. And that is Finland, the three Baltic states, and Poland. And the rest belong really to soft Europe, as Minister of Defense, I hope it's correct, Kyucha mentioned this morning. And that's a fundamental distinction. Here I should also mention, I know that there are some Norwegians here, Norway is halfway in the front line. But these five states, they're distinguished by two things. One is geography and history. The geography is that they all have a long land frontier directly with Russia. And it's very close to the national heartland, capital, population, industry, and so on. And the second thing is history. The three Baltic states and Poland were occupied by Russia, Soviet Union during the Cold War. And Finland had to struggle every second of those 4.5 decades to maintain their independence from constant Soviet pressures to try and reduce or remove Finland's independence. And this history means, it has three implications for the way these countries see the world. The one is they have a very deep insight into the Russian spirit, the psyche, the thinking, and the modus operandi of the Russians. And that is absolutely crucial. The second thing is that they have a very, very realpolitical awareness. They think in terms of realpolitics, and especially they are aware of the sort of brute power politics which Russia is able to use. That's essential, and that again distinguishes them from the soft Europe that the minister mentioned. And the third thing is that there is a constant awareness of the Russian threat. This doesn't mean that there is a sort of a psychosis or a panic all the time, but it just means that the potential for a Russian threat is present in everything the countries do and constantly. And not just among a small group of experts or the elite political establishment. The whole society, media, political group, and so on. And this is essential. It means that one behaves and carries out security policy in a very different way from if one does not have this awareness. And it shapes the narrative. And that brings me to the perception of the narrative. And here I'll distinguish two. It's, on the one hand, it's a little bit hard to know what NATO's narrative is right now. There are several out there. But if we go back to the legacy narrative, as Lord Ismay presented it, to keep Germany down, Russia out, America in, of course, no one's thinking of Germany down. But the Russia out aspect permeates everything. I mean, this is the fundamental, it's the number one concern that is constantly there, constantly present. And the second bit, keeping the US in, is also there. I mean, basically in that respect, NATO is seen as the instrument for keeping the US present. Everyone, even Finland, who's only a partner, realizes that the US presence, especially war-fighting presence in Europe, is absolutely essential if Russia is going to be deterred. Because it is quite correct, as the minister said, that if there's an opening, Russia has a tendency to move in. And the United States is ultimately the only one that can really fill that opening. So how does this affect the way they view the NATO narrative? I'll put it in five points. The one, if we start with the capacity to keep Russia out, we can divide that into three parts. The one is the indirect war that Russia is waging against us right now. That is the information war, trying to disrupt our societies, confuse us, and then also the preparations for sabotage of our vital technical infrastructure, the other kind of information war that's going on. And here, I'm not an expert in that area, but I have a feeling that there is a feeling in the Nordic frontline states that NATO is actually addressing this challenge. That there is work going on and that it's moving ahead. Whether or not it's enough, I can't go into. But the second challenge here is, of course, the conventional defense of Europe against Russian military force. And here is the great concern. Here is the feeling that we already heard it, actually. Not enough is being done, and it's being done too late. This doesn't mean that nothing is being done. There's a clear awareness that the US, since Ukraine, has shifted its policy, has started to place a more or less permanent presence in Poland. And this is largely due and here I must congratulate our Polish colleagues for a very concerted Polish effort to try and achieve a permanent US presence in Poland. And then, of course, NATO has developed the forward and enhanced presence, and is developing the VJTF forces. So these things are moving ahead. The problem here is that there's a feeling that there just isn't enough going on. And we just need to look at the two last Russian Western exercises, Zapad 2013, Zapad 2017, to see. I mean, both of these exercises, the Russians exercised about some 100,000 men. And they have also increased, since 2010, the capabilities of these forces. So they now, we estimate that they have a 1 to 2 day readiness to put into action combat battalion teams, 3 to 4 days to get their brigades into action, and about 8 to 10 days to get their army level offensive underway. And this is just too fast. NATO cannot really react to that. We do have a great expert here on this, Phil Peterson, so he can go into this in greater detail than I can today. And the second thing is and then there's a third level, and that is nuclear deterrence, European nuclear deterrence. And I'll go into that because that is the most fundamental issue. I'll have that as my last fifth point. But the second thing then is this concern about a lack of understanding of Russia that is taking place in soft Europe. There are pockets of experts who are really very, very good on Russia. And of course, one of them was sitting to my left, James Scher. But the problem in soft Europe is that these are small, isolated groups, drops really in a bucket. And the system as such, the political establishment, the public, the media, and so on, do not have that awareness. And that makes it more difficult to implement a serious policy on Russia. The third concern is over the United States. And of course, the headlines now are Trump, and that's one simply doesn't know how Trump could go. But there is also a question now about whether, in fact, regardless of Trump, the United States may be reducing its commitment to Europe. Already before Trump came, we had the shift to the Pacific, the reduced, very much reduced presence in Europe. That was, of course, before Ukraine 2014. Yeah, so that has changed the U.S. But there is a concern, is there a deeper shift in Europe? And here, I'm glad to say we have Professor Wolforth here, and he may be, and his team, his strong team from Dartmouth, may be able to enlighten us a bit about how the U.S. is going. And the fourth concern in the Nordics is particularly perhaps in Norway, because the frontline states are so preoccupied with dealing with Russia that they don't really have time to look at too much else. But Norway, of course, is looking at the Arctic. And here there's a concern that NATO doesn't have an Arctic strategy. And we do need one, because the Arctic is melting. China and Russia are going to be very active there in security political terms. Russia is building up, I mean, of course, during the Cold War, the Arctic was always the main battlefield of the strategic nuclear forces and submarines. But Russia is now building up a conventional capability for the Arctic, which is quite unique. Huge bases, special types of surface ships that can break through the ice, special types of military units that can operate in the ice, and so on. So this is a concern, and this is something that perhaps Jon Andreas Olsen here, who I think is here from the Norwegian Embassy, can go into in deeper, greater depth than I can. And then my final point, and that's the lack of European nuclear deterrence. We simply don't have it, and I'm completely aware, of course, of the various NATO documents, and certainly the improvement in the American awareness with the last nuclear posture review, 2018. But I should mention the last 10 years of the Cold War I spent in Norway looking at Soviet military preparations in the north. And all of our work then was, every day, was actually linked to the extended nuclear deterrence in Europe. And the amount of effort that went into making sure that we could handle a nuclear crisis, if, say, the Soviets in those days, now today the Russians, if they put their nuclear weapons on full alert and say we're ready to use them. First of all, the level of terror that strikes in you, one has to have experience to know that. And secondly, the amount of preparations that it takes to do that. Everything from the top political leadership having a joint policy on this and making it public, because that's part of deterrence, down to the strategic thinking and then the concrete preparations, all the way from the hospitals down to the people who have to drive the bulldozers who are going to make the mass graves to bury all the dead. Everything like these massive preparations and the biannual reforger exercises where the whole NATO system was mobilized to simulate to deal with a nuclear crisis. All of that is gone. I mean, we have some B-61 bombs left in five countries in Europe, and that's not a nuclear deterrent. And this is our absolutely greatest weakness, that the Russians, or Putin, has in his sleeve the capacity to exert nuclear coercion against Europe, and we are completely vulnerable to that, totally. Yeah. I'm absolutely convinced if Putin were to put his forces, nuclear forces on full alert and threaten their use, there is no way that NATO or individual countries even, or certainly not the EU, could deal with that kind of crisis. The good thing is, of course, that one doesn't do that lightly. I mean, that's a is a major move. And Putin he's not a gambler. He's an excellent poker player, but he's not a gambler. He's a very calculating person. So he won't do that unless he really feels he can gain a lot from it. And we can go into Russian motives, because that's actually crucial here. That's part of this lack of understanding we feel in the frontline states of how Putin is thinking. If Putin is going to do something military in the Baltic area, it's not going to be to get some territory. I mean, that is so trivial. He doesn't have to worry about that. If he does it, it's because he wants to have a political effect, an impact on Europe. And the type of impact it would be, one would be to break NATO, if NATO is unable to then defend. And the other one, the deeper one, is to install fear in European governments and societies. Because actually, Russia, Putin, has only one way of influencing us, and that's through the Russian military force, brutal force. And it must be terribly frustrating for him to see that we're too stupid to realize that we should recognize this, and therefore we should take Russian vital interests into account. It must be very frustrating for him. So the frightening situation is, if he feels at some point that he can do something that can really terrify our publics, our societies, and the leadership, so that we start to realize, yes, we should sit down with Putin and renegotiate the European Security Order, and preferably without the US. That would be the strategic objective that Putin would have. And that's what really worries me. But with that, I hand over to James Scherr, who knows more about this than I do.
James, I see you nodding in agreement.
Well, there's been absolutely no consultation between us. Now, see how many still believe that at the conclusion of my remarks. First, I also would like to thank both the New Strategy Center and LSE Ideas for conceiving of this event and convening it. Unfortunately, like London buses, good conferences tend to come in threes. And so I apologize in advance for the fact that in the middle of the next panel, I will unceremoniously have to slip out. 3 points. First, in 2014, deterrence re-entered the NATO lexicon for the first time in 23 years. By then, not only the structures of deterrence had been dismantled, but the culture of deterrence had been dismantled. Contrary to conventional wisdom, NATO enlargement did not prepare us for any of the challenges we face now, because it was predicated on the view that military force would no longer be an instrument of policy in Europe, particularly amongst great powers. And hypothetical question. Supposing the Georgian war conflict occurred before we admitted the three Baltic states to NATO, would we have admitted them? I don't know. But we regarded this era as over. Before the NATO enlargement process started, all three Baltic states were thinking through defense doctrines in response to threats that we now call hybrid war. Once that process started, all of this stopped. And they were obliged at great cost to restructure all of their forces, not to defend national territory, they lost the understanding of that, but to support NATO allies in places like the Balkans, and then after 2001 in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, and so on. When the Russo-Georgia war started in August 2008, there was a US train and a group there. None of these forces were being trained to defend Georgia's national territory, and if it's four brigades, its best brigade at the time was deployed in Iraq. So that's where we were. During the Cold War, the inner German border was probed by the Soviet Union and its GDR allies on at least 165 occasions. And on every occasion, NATO demonstrated there is somebody there. On every occasion, there was a response. That generation is no longer around, and instead we have people who believe that our imperative when we are tested is not to be provocative. And I can think of a number of occurrences since 2014 where we have been tested and have either done nothing at all in response or done the most inappropriate thing possible. And this is a generational and cultural change. Second point. Despite everything we have seen involving the changes of borders, and in one case, in the case of Crimea, outright annexation since 2014, I must restate a highly counterintuitive point. Russia's fundamental objective is not to change the physical borders of Europe, it is to change the political borders of Europe. In the Russian perspective, there are three Europes. There is the historical West. And the Russians are being absolutely sincere when they say, we have no quarrel with the historical West, but that is essentially the West behind the Neisser River. It is Holy Roman Empire plus. It is our civilizational space. That's where we belong. There is then Russkiy Mir, the Russian world, this whole civilizational space that Russia has played a determining role and influence in, which is to some extent Russian, and this is an area of concentric circles of dependence and subordination to Russia, and unfortunately, some of those spaces and lines cut right through the territory of NATO allies. In Narva, in Estonia, where I live, in Latgala and Latvia, of course, we can multiply some of these examples. So this is less benign than it sounds, particularly when you understand that the tools being used to further this political ambition are not all political. They are economic, they are military, they are unconventional, involve various forms of info war, and so on and so forth. So if I have a plea, it is, please do not assume that we can take the NATO-non-NATO geographical distinction for granted, because the Russians don't recognize its essential legitimacy. They might respect NATO, but the only thing they respect is the correlation of forces, or an effective correlation of forces, because as they see it, the political West has gone well beyond the historical West and has encroached into Russia's historical and vital zone of interest. And this is a deep fundamental difference in outlook and in worldviews. My third point, the Russian military and political establishment, again, not just today the military establishment, but the political establishment, and here this is something different from the 1990s, take war seriously. This is not because they have an interest in starting a war. They have no political interest today in starting a war. It is because they view the reality and the possibility of war as intrinsic to a system which they now define in terms of противоборство, which is a wonderful ambiguous Russian term which can mean confrontation or antagonism, but let's call it antagonism. In the scheme of contending political interests, civilizational spaces, worldviews, war is possible. If there is to be a war, to paraphrase what Bismarck said about revolution, if there is to be a revolution, we would rather make it than suffer it. That defines the Russian approach to war as it defined the Soviet approach to war. And the aim, and I'm directly reinforcing what Thomas has said, in war, and the whole structure of forces and deployment, exercises, everything else, would be to shatter NATO as swiftly and dramatically as possible and bring us to the negotiating table to discuss peace on Russia's terms. It is a short war strategy, and to be successful, it depends upon convincing, terrifying capabilities of escalation dominance at every single level. Have we done enough to make this more difficult? Yes. Have we done enough to feel confident about European security today? Again, I would agree, no. At least now there is a critical mass of key players in NATO who understand that our challenge is to persuade Russia that there's no such thing as a short war against NATO. That how, if you attack any NATO ally, however you do it, you are at war with all of NATO. That is what these forward presences are about. The problem is that there is still an unarticulated division between those who think it's important enough just to have forces that symbolize this kind of readiness, and others who say, no, the Russians are not impressed by that. There needs to be a capability that creates one in the Cold War, the Germans in particular, in the context of flexible response, would call a chain of ineluctable steps that make short war planning and execution impossible. And my last point, one sentence, is that to say that serious as our military weaknesses are, our political weaknesses are much more glaring and they are far more important. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much to our three speakers. If I see a common theme there, I think it's the question of resilience, and that was the word, Ambassador, you brought up. A book came out on resilience, a popular book a couple of years ago, and the definition of the two authors was the ability of an institution to maintain its core purpose. You also mentioned the eminent group of people who are trying, I think, to define what that core purpose is. We had it in the Cold War. It was the Harmel Commission in 1967, deterrence and détente. And we still had vigorous political debates as to whether deterrence was credible or not, or were we doing enough in détente. But it was this formula, a very, very simple formula. That was the core purpose of NATO. Could I ask each of you, before I open it up to the audience, to define in a few words what you think NATO's core purpose for the next 10 years is, if it's possible to define a core purpose?
Well, first of all, a quick reaction to the very distinguished speakers. I listened carefully and took notes, very valuable observations. And I can recognize those challenges that they voiced. I fully subscribe to these concerns. Nevertheless, we should also put the efforts of NATO in the recent past in a context. With the peace dividend, we all know that NATO allies cut spending, and basically there was a decline in defense spending. But when we take 2014 and the defense investment pledge at Wales, we have been making quite a progress in stopping the cuts and increasing defense spending, and also to strengthen deterrence and defense of NATO. And I think when you put the question, what should be the fundamental priorities for NATO, I think we should continue in our efforts to strengthen our deterrence and defense. There may be lacking areas which we need to fill the gap, and it is not easy when you talk about 29 allies, soon to be 30, to have a coherent effort to bring results. We should at the same time, of course, not neglecting the challenges, threats emanating from the East, should also be able to address the challenges emanating from other directions, including the South. So fighting terrorism, I think, would be one important challenge for allies to face. And perhaps in the northern and eastern part of the alliance, it is true that the Russian threat is something felt in their daily lives and due to their history. But when you go to the south, the allies are also concerned about those challenges emanating from the south, like terrorism, migration. So NATO should be able to address all these challenges. Third, it should also have to follow the shift of competition and power, global power. And that's why China is one country that we have to watch carefully. Not with a view to finding a new adversary, on the contrary, to see what challenges growing China could pose to our security, but also see opportunities, how to better engage with China in addressing these security challenges. I think when we talk about all these fundamental issues, one important element we need to keep in mind is to keep this transatlantic bond as strong as ever. Yes, from time to time, with one tweet or one statement, the minds of our publics can get confused, ours as well. But actions speak louder than words. And we see that the U.S. commitment to European security is strong. I can give only one example. Next year, there will be a Defender 2020 exercise, and 20,000 American soldiers will be brought from the United States to Europe for that exercise. It will be an exercise with troops size of 37,000 from all allied countries. There are efforts of the U.S. for the European defense, so we need to also see that there is an unwavering support to NATO from the U.S. side. In April, Secretary General addressed the joint session of the U.S. Congress, and his address was interrupted with 23 standing ovations. It's a bipartisan support, and the U.S. leaders, President Trump, Secretary Pompeo, time and again repeated their solemn commitment to NATO. One word on NATO-EU cooperation, because when we talk about the complexity of the security environment that we live in, it is not a choice but necessity, a necessity for NATO to cooperate well with the European Union, especially in such areas where the competences and capacities are different, and we need to create synergies and complement each other, from countering terrorism to countering hybrid threats. And we are doing a lot. For instance, there was a reference to challenges in the information space. More and more, we are exposed to disinformation and propaganda campaigns. But NATO is sharpening its capacity. The division that I had is working hard in developing a proper information environment assessment capability to have early warnings of hybrid threats in the form of disinformation and propaganda, but also with a view to calibrating our own communication. But our main goal is in this contested information space to make sure that NATO's positive narrative features in a prominent fashion so that our publics could have the capacity to make a distinction between facts and fiction. And one last word on the political dimension that I was referring to. Yes, military capabilities are extremely important, and I agree with this previous speaker, Dr. Scher, that definitely while strengthening our military capacity, we should also be able to focus on the political dimension. And that's why we need to see the recent decision of the leaders to have this reflection process with the support of a group of eminent experts, an important step. And I hope that it will provide the necessary input for our leaders to take the work forward in the years to come.
Yes, right.
There is also from time to time a mention of whether there is any necessity to revise the NATO strategic concept. And I'm sure that we will have such a debate in the years to come. But I have to give a strong sense with the audience that since 2014, NATO leaders made so many important decisions that they guide our work. And the strategic concept of 2010 with three core functions, collective defense, crisis management, and cooperative security still guides us. And these decisions complement what strategic concept has laid out in 2010. And I'm sure that time will come to consolidate all these decisions in a new strategic concept. But the main purpose of this reflection process is not to embark upon redrafting the strategic concept, but focusing only on the political dimension of NATO.
Thank you very much. Well, of course, a group of eminent persons is unlikely to, experts is unlikely to go down well with Michael Gove. But perhaps one should try and find another word if Boris Johnson is still Prime Minister by 2021. Now, can I ask the two panellists to come back on that? Please don't forget my question about the core purpose.
No, I'm not.
At the end.
I haven't.
And secondly, global and China. Perhaps you could address those two. Tom, would you like to go first?
Well, thank you. Yes, I do remember your core point, and that's the important one. NATO faces many challenges, but the priority, the closest one, the toughest one is Russia. So that for me would be the absolute priority number one. That doesn't exclude China. China is an emerging challenge, which we have to start thinking about, but Russia is the acute one. And then the second thing, I think you hit the nail right on the head with the Harmel report. Russia is too big and too powerful for us simply to try and push away by unilateral defense and deterrence measures. And that's also going the Russian way. We will have to balance a much stronger defense and deterrence with some sort of reassurance policy. Not necessarily a detente, but some sort of reassurance policy. And here James can go in much greater detail than I, but what I understand is that the Putin regime, at the mildest, they feel terribly insecure towards the West. They really would like to have back this sort of historical Russian buffer zone along Russia's European borders. At the strongest, they feel that we are actually been actively attacking them ever since the end of the Cold War, actually starting 1982 with the Solidarnosc. They feel that the war never, and that's the other factor, they feel that we are constantly threatening and attacking them. And that's even more of a reason to have this buffer zone. The problem is that how are we going to square that circle? For us, the idea of a Russian buffer zone where they have some kind of exclusive rights over the security policies of their border countries is so totally against our basic values and, of course, against practically everyone in this room who comes from these countries. And this is going to be a really difficult nut to crack.
I would, first of all, what our core purpose is not. It is not to change Russia. It is not even to change Russian thinking. It is not our place to do that. And basically, apart from the mythical experts Tom speaks about, we don't know how to do that. We are no good at it. We have made a mess of it when we've tried it, and we have provided narratives and justifications for the worst people to think the worst of us. Our core task is to maintain the integrity and security of the alliance, irrespective of what happens inside Russia and whether the Russians like this or not. Our second task, almost as important, is to provide all reasonable means of support to our partners, especially our most embattled ones, I would single out Georgia and Ukraine, short of war. War is off the table if we are not talking about the alliance and collective security. And the third, fundamental to deterrence, is to persuade the very serious, very rational, very pragmatic people, not only in the Kremlin, but in the general staff, at all key establishments in Russia, that war is not the solution, cannot be the solution to their problems. And by doing this, as long as it takes to stimulate a discussion inside Russia about Russian national interests, but it is not our business to intrude in that. And the worst thing possible is to lecture the Russians about their own national interests. And it is fundamentally inappropriate and insulting, and we do it all the time. And our goodwill. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much. We have time for one question, if there's anybody who has a burning desire. Come back. Yes, at the back.
Yes. William Wolf.
Bill Wolfer from Dartmouth College. Just wondering if you could speculate on the downside. Let's say we don't do these things you say we should do.
Right. Let us say, just for per hypothesis, that NATO does not do what you say it needs to do with respect to Russia, and Russia actually achieves this objective, which James Scherr rightly notes is political in its essence, and creates a kind of new security architecture in Europe. What's the downside? How would you explain to an American audience? I know I don't want you to lecture to Americans what their national interest should be, but how would you explain to an American audience how that outcome is bad for U.S. security? Just to put some preface to this remark, the fundamental premise of American grand strategy from the beginning of the Cold War, and indeed in Second World War, was to prevent the accumulation of power in Europe such that it could threaten the American homeland. But would the outcome that you foresee, if NATO fails in its task, constitute such an agglomeration of power that the United States grand strategy would, that this definition of American fundamental national interests would be imperiled?
Yeah. Very, you know, if I had my 30 seconds with Donald Trump, and I wouldn't have longer, I don't overestimate the art of the possible, I would just say to him, I'm very puzzled. You believe in America first. You believe in American primacy in so many respects. Why can you not see that the alliances you criticize institutionalize America first in so many ways and do so on the cheap? And that if you had to do this all by yourself, it would jeopardize every other sensible priority that you have, Mr. President. I hope that at least answers your question, William.
There was more than 30 seconds. He would have left the room by then. Right, I think that note, we have a break now until 12 o'clock, and we then have our second panel, in which many of these issues will be revisited, which is the challenges that NATO faces in the Black Sea. Can I invite you, meanwhile, just to thank our three speakers. Thank you very much.